Blog Talk Radio.
Because we want to stay alive in Torah Chaim, instructions of life, Torah Ches, instructions of kindness, Torah Rachmim, instructions of mercies. This is the 171st class of Soul Class. Tonight's show will be a little bit different than our normal programming, but one thing that hasn't changed is that we open up the show and we're now going to be turning down the volume for Isaac Patone's Here Comes the Time from his Generation Redemption album. It's a CD that came out earlier this year, and I hope you'll check it out. You can check it out on Isaac Patone's Facebook page and just Google up ISAACBITTON. And before bringing our co-host, we just want to read the following message to all of you. Blessed is our Creator. Although this day is usually reserved for in search of ancient Torah, we are preempting the usual format with a heartfelt discussion about a moment of silence, which was originally suggested by the Lubavitcher Rebbe during the late 20th century. This show will feature your humble cyberspace Torah activist, that's me, reading from a newsletter written by Izzy Kalman, who is, I believe, a clinical psychologist who wrote this for part of this article that I'm going to read to you, which was in part published in also the L'Chaim magazine, published by the Lubavitch organization. So part of this article was written originally for the Psychology Today blog. And Mr. Kalman has a website you may find interesting, blessed souls, called bullies2buddies.com. That's bullies, B-U-L-L-I-E-S 2, the number 2, buddies, B-U-D-D-I-E-S.com. And to learn more about this concept of a moment of silence, you can go to momentofsilence.info. Also, if you go eventually to the archive version, Blessed Souls, I did not cut and paste it correctly because I acted kind of hastily in putting the show together, unfortunately. There is a wonderful video by a good friend of mine who prays with me in the Frankel Shul here in Kesakron Heights of Brooklyn, New York, by the name of Shimon Warrenker, who was the principal of PS 770 here in Crown Heights. And he gave a 24-minute lecture recently on parent and educational skills and how the two can crisscross, the plus and minuses of them. And before we go further into the show, let's bring in our co-host, Rambam student, Rambam teacher, Rambam advocate, Dennis Ryan. Good evening, Dennis.
Good evening, Don, and good evening, listeners.
And as even before we go into this program, the content, which we're making a little bit of changes here, a little bit of a surprise at the last moment. I'm very taken by these matters that we're hopefully we'll be discussing tonight. I do want to mention something on a secular level as well, something that I experienced earlier this week. You know, blessed souls, I'm in the field of mental health, and earlier this or late last week on Wednesday, I actually went to my first Mets game at Citi Field. And one thing that took me by surprise, I wasn't prepared for it, and I hope Dennis will comment on my surprise, what he thinks about it, is that, you know, let's face it, I mean, baseball sports are a prime example of pure capitalism, probably in some ways, on a microcosmic sense, some of the purest forms of capitalism in the country. So at a baseball stadium, everything is marked out, I'm sure, inch by inch, foot by foot, yard by yard, square meter by square meter, on how to most best maximize the profit for the team. I mean, they have a lot of expenses. They have to, they built, I think, this new Citi Field is a $1 billion venture. And the Mets, of course, as we know, those of us who are a little familiar with the sports world, had almost were decimated, the owners, financially, and almost had the team taken away from them, and they were able to get out of it. That's great. However, when you walk around the stadium, almost every available space where an advertisement can be put up, there's an advertisement. Every available space where there can be a concession stand, there's a concession stand. However, one stand took me by surprise. I had not expected it. I've heard about this concept on the radio, but it was the first time I saw that they actually had a concession stand, and it wasn't a large one. However, it was taking up space in the stadium where they could have been selling their goods and services. It was basically a stand where if a person knew they were going to drink too much beer or liquor, or say like vodka, some sort of solution, liquid refreshment that would cause them to be legally intoxicated and could threaten themselves and others, you can actually bring your keys to this concession stand and give the keys over, and a designated driver would be given over to you to take you home safely that night. And I was taken aback by that considering the financial pressure the New York Mets are under and considering the financial advantages that are afforded the team to maximize every inch of available commercial space for concession stands or whatever you want to call it, those areas of capitalist transactions, I found it very refreshing to see that they took the time to do an act of kindness. Of course, the team doesn't want to be known as and the organization doesn't want to be a place that will empower people to get drunk and then hurt themselves and hurt others. I mean, if a person kills another person, it could be potentially affecting generations of people that would have emanated out of that person, especially a pregnant mother. So, Dennis, I was very taken. It gave me a good feeling in my heart that slowly but surely the message is getting into the mindset of the masses of people and the masses of investors or big businessmen, that sometimes you really do have to give back, even the smallest amount, and hopefully we'll catch a fire and ignite others to do more kindness and to think more about it's more than just about the bottom line, where this country has been known as being that the business of America is business. Well, the business of America might not just be not just the business of making money, but the business of doing kindness. Dennis, any comments, questions, and concerns about what I just shared with everyone and yourself, of course?
Well, I can see where you would call it kindness. I would say they're trying to reduce their liability. On top of that, a lot of the brewers and manufacturers of alcohol chip in money to get these things so that they're more human, as opposed to just trying to get people drunk or intoxicated, that they want to make them aware of what's going on. You see it on TV in a lot of ads. Also, 20 years ago in this country, we started a drunk driving campaign in a lot of schools all over the United States. Those kids are no longer kids. They're 20 years older. And I know when they go as a group to any of these sporting events, they always designate somebody to be the non-drinking driver. So, therefore, they agree ahead of time before they go there, regardless of what happens, that this person who's designated as the driver doesn't drink because he's in charge of driving everybody back. So this was something that has been planted in the minds of kids about 20 years ago, and we're starting to see the fruition of that. So, yes, it isn't the charity of the owners. I look at it as the caring principle of one student to another or friend to another. In other words, it's an extension of humanity.
True. Well, I mean, we have a saying, Dennis, that by the most of we say, Hateva lahatov, Hateva hatov lehetiv. It is the nature of the good to do good. And the word hetiv means there's a certain diligence involved in doing that good. And I just, maybe because, I was not aware, because I've been out of secular education a good 20 years, I'd say even a good 26, 27 years, I openly acknowledge my ignorance to these matters that were brought, that you just brought to my attention. It just, I want to, when I see something which I think I consider to be positive, I want to try to advocate on my own humble level that let it be considered not just as preventing liability, but a tool to educate all of us. Even though that night, even though I was the driver of the van of the individuals I took to the game, I certainly wasn't going to drink because I can't drink any sort of alcoholic substance while I'm in the middle of my work. That would lead to an absolute, immediate dismissal of my job, which I don't feel like doing that in such an irresponsible manner. So I just wanted to throw that out there, and I wanted to use it as the prelude to this next section. Unless you, if you want to add something else, then please do, and then we'll move on to the next section. An article that was written by Izzy Common, a nationally certified school psychologist. It's called "The Slice of Life: Simple Solutions Are Best." So, if you have anything else to conclude on this, go ahead. If not, we'll move on.
One of the problems was that sometimes when the groups got together, they would say, "Okay, you're the driver." And then they had a dilemma if the driver lost his keys for any reason whatsoever. Some of them would use it as an excuse, whatever it is. So what happens is in a lot of ballparks and a lot of other areas, they have like a keyboard, like you do valet service for cars. They put keys there just for the safe drivers, and those are the ones they'll give the keys back to when they check their eyes or look at them or try to smell their breath and say, "Okay, be careful."
Uh-huh. Okay, very good. Thank you. Again, I appreciate your informing on matters that I was just, not aware of. But let's move on now, Dennis, and blessed souls, if those of you are listening out there will eventually catch us on the archive version. This is, again, called "A Slice of Life," and this is just a slice of an article that was written for a blog for Psychology Today, which most people are probably aware of, those who have some level of high school and upper and four-year college education, aware of the magazine Psychology Today. This is called "The Slice of Life: Simplest Solutions Are Best" by Izzy Common, a nationally certified school psychologist. And he writes as follows: "I am a lover of simple solutions. While we tend to think that solutions are difficult, this is usually wrong. It is problems that are difficult. Usually when we find a solution that works, it turns out to be something very simple." Now, I just want to mention one thing, that although the solution might seem to be very simple, implementing the solution, that can be just as difficult as the problem that was presented that served as the antecedent to the solution. Dennis, would you like to comment on that brief commentary by myself?
Well, what happens is we like to come up with solutions, but not many of us can define what the problem is. And that is one of the causes, because we're jumping all around after the impact as opposed to the cause. So the original Greek thinking of solutions was, the first step was, you must define the problem as much detail as possible. If you can, you stand a chance of overcoming it or coming out with solutions.
Beautiful. Okay, we're going to continue on with the article. "Several years ago, a man in the audience of a class that I gave called Anger Control Made Easy Seminar in Manhattan stood out to me like a sore thumb. He sported a long gray beard and wore a white shirt, black suit, and the particular style of black hat that comprised the unofficial uniform of Chabad Hasidim," which I can say that is basically our unofficial uniform. "I was, in fact, very surprised that a Lubavitcher Chassid would attend my secular seminar. I was even more surprised to see that this man wanted to stay afterwards to talk to me. He introduced himself as Avraham Frank," who actually appeared on one of our early shows, Dennis. I don't know if you recall it, but he called in within the first year of our initial humble efforts, And he talked about this idea of a moment of silence in the school system, not just the yeshiva system, but the secular school system. So he introduced himself as Avraham Frank, and he wanted more advice on how to apply my teachings in his work, meaning he wanted to implement the teachings of Izzy Kalman, a school psychologist, in his work. So we ended up keeping sporadic phone call contact ever since. Mr. Frank told me about a mission he had taken upon himself on his own time and expense. He'd been promoting a school program called A Moment of Silence. He tries to convince schools to implement a minute or two of silence every morning. This is not a new idea. There are several states in the U.S. that have mandated a moment of silence for schools. But Mr. Frank's version has a particular twist to it. The students are requested to discuss with their parents what they should be contemplating during the moment of silence in school. As I will be discussing shortly, this make all the difference. Mr. Frank told me the results have been amazing. I was initially skeptical, but when I looked at dozens of letters from kids and the video testimonials, from teachers, principals, and parents, I was greatly impressed and curious. Mr. Frank explained that he promotes the program because the late Lubavitcher Rebbe had expressed the desire to see all schools implementing a moment of silence. Now, Mr. Kalman then goes on to say, regardless of one's religious beliefs or lack of such, when a man like the Lubavitcher Rebbe makes a recommendation for society, it would be smart to give it consideration. In addition to being a Jewish scholar, Rabbi Schneerson was a true genius and a profoundly wise man, and wisdom is the solution to life's problems. So I gave a moment of silence some consideration, and for the past year or so have been mentioning it in my monthly Bullies to Bullies newsletters. Now, he writes here Bullies to Bullies, B-U-L-L-I-E-S, then he writes T-O, Buddies, but his website is listed as Buddies with the numerical 2 to Buddies newsletters. So anyone out there who wants to check out his newsletter, either try it either way. And as a result, many schools throughout the world have adopted a moment of silence, and they love the results. Why does a moment of silence work? I will do my best to offer some explanations. So he gives basically 5 reasons why, and then we'll ask Dennis to chime in. 1, it is a powerful experience. If you ever participated in a memorial service in which everyone is silent for a minute or 2 minutes, you probably know what it is like. Time seems to pass more slowly as everyone is united in a communal ceremony of thoughtful silence. The second benefit of this program, it promotes self-control. It is not easy to be silent and still for a full minute or two, and the younger the child is, the more difficult it is. So when a child practices silence for a minute or two every day, they attain self-control that can be available to them at any time. 3, when the moment of silence is conducted at the beginning of the school day, it sets the mood for the rest of the day. 4, it can serve as a form of meditation for kids. The benefits of meditation have been well established by scientific research, and of course Rambam writes in the Foundations of the Torah that it is one of the fundamental principles of Torah and spiritual seeking to meditate. And the 5th factor I'll present is that what has to do with the particular component Rabbi Schneerson added, instructing kids to discuss with the parents what they should think about. This factor is perhaps the most crucial for the success of the program. Students are largely in a moral, spiritual limbo. Their homes' lives revolve around homework and electronic devices, and schools have become mere college prep factories, and parents are expected to pay the bills and drive the kids around, bring them to play dates, and make sure they do their homework, etc. And that is where the Lubavitcher Rebbe's brilliance comes in. With his version of the moment of silence, schools can restore to parents their rightful role as the moral/spiritual authorities for their children. The schools are in essence declaring to students, quote, your parents are the ones you need to look to, for the meaning in life, end of quote. Now, there's 2 more paragraphs, but I'd like Dennis to chime in.
I like the idea. I think it makes a lot of sense. But in America, it may be a little too much common sense for America. For a long time, we promulgated the concept of saying a little prayer before the school day. We even tried it in public schools that were heavily influenced by the community that they were in. And court cases upon court cases upon court cases. And then someone said, well, let's have a moment of silence. Well, the court cases just kept coming in because they said, that's just subterfuge of what you're trying to do is create a prayer in the school, and we have to have separation of prayer, blah, 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 blah. The concept here of that the silence is going to be premeditated or influenced by the parents talking to the child is a nice concept. It should have been going on long before it was proposed, even. However, you mentioned the word difficult, and the word difficult is very important here because you have kids all different ages, and we all know how restless they get when they're in school. And to tell them all of a sudden silence is golden or silence is good, they're going to look at you kind of funny and say, what are you talking about? This is school. Let's get on with it. So it's very hard now to tell them that just keep your mouth shut and listen to nothing except your own thoughts. If they haven't practiced it, how are they going to ever use it?
True, I hear you. If I'm not mistaken, the aim of the program is to start with children in the earliest grades as possible. Yeah, I can see that if you start in a middle school or in high school, which I guess is, 9th through 12th grade, that it might be hard to implement. However, you know, the results that the testimonials I have seen have been basically with early grade school children. The thing is I think that there's a certain vulnerability that naturally exists between transmitter of knowledge and receiver of knowledge, but I think, unfortunately, the way the educational systems work is that they want to deny there's a vulnerability rather than say that we are the authority, you are the receptors or the receivers of our authority, do not step into the turf of our authority. So I think this is I'm agreeing with you in part, Dennis, that this is a great difficulty. However, hopefully, in the 1950s, I took a training, a three-day training with the Office of Department of Mental Health and Mental Health Hygiene in New York City last year. I mean, and my father even told me this as well. When you went into the Army in the 1950s as a draft inductee, one of the things you were rewarded with is becoming a U.S. soldier. You were given a carton of cigarettes. Now, back then,
coffin nails weren't coffin nails.
I'm sorry?
Coffin nails weren't coffin nails back then.
Yeah. No, and I was told by a neighbor who lives across the street from me that in the 1950s, a cigar was promoted as an aid to digestion after a meal. But we know otherwise. So, for those people who grew up in the 50s and are unfortunate, were exposed to smoking and they became addicted to the smoking because we know there's horrible chemical agents in the smoking, embedded in the nicotine. You know, it happened. So hopefully, again, I'm going to take a, before I read these last three paragraphs, that I'm going to take a hopefully optimistic viewpoint. I still want to believe that although America has suffered from a certain lack of common sense, and not just America, I mean, countries around the world, let's face it. I mean, you know, I don't like to blame all the problems of the world on America, as some would like to, because we have a saying, while one is pointing at others, one is being pointed at by others as well. So, you know, and as one of my teachers once said about certain issues that existed in the Jewish community, he found that he got a sense of relief and calming that the problems that were embedded in contemporary Jewish life were not something that we created, but we were inherited from generations gone by. So there are problems here in this, you know, modern, and, you know, America is what, is 236 years old as a country, formal country from 1776. And, you know, it's done tremendous in terms of, going from a slave driven economy to, well, an economy that's kind of like shipwrecked now, but at least hopefully we do not expect to slavery to be reinstituted as an option to regenerate the economy. It's a country that has gone through many, many changes, and I hope that part of the positive changes that still can have yet to come for this country is this one small point of starting with the young ones, the new generation, and give them and educate them and work with the parents and for the teachers or the educational systems to expose their vulnerability, meaning they cannot be the total authority. The parent is the moral, ultimately the moral and ethical authority of their child's, you know, present destiny in the existential sense, and then hopefully the schools will work on that sense of right and wrong that hopefully the child is getting transmitted to from their parents, and guide them with the ABCs and the mathematics and the, you know, the proper grammar and all the computer technology they'll need to deal with the modern world as we move on into the future.
Well,
I know
Don,
you want to comment, Dennis. Yeah.
Yeah. Moment of silence or reflection is a very good idea, but it has to be a groundswell from the parents to get to the administrators of the education. And that's only halfway there, even if you get that agreement, because the teachers have to go along with it, but most of the teachers have unions. And the union will say, well, this is not really part of a teacher's duties, because everything has to go through collective bargaining. So you would say, wait a minute, if the administrators and the parents like it, why not? Well, it just doesn't work that way. So what happens is it has to go through even a political process. And unfortunately, common sense gets chopped up, rearranged, and who knows what it comes out as. But you've got to remember that there are several parameters that must be present and work in unison, unified was the word I believe you used, that in order for this to work so that the kids can benefit from it.
True, I hear you. So, Dennis, I want to go and just to read over the last three paragraphs, and then we're going to take our usual musical break with some beautiful music by Kikaro.
Don, I hate to interrupt you on a short program like this, but I had an incident where I ran into a friend of mine who was an ultra-conservative. Yes, a black hat, no doubt about it. And I want to relate that. It's a short story. When you get a chance, if we have time, I'd like to talk about it. Okay?
Well, I'll tell you what, then. Let's finish these three paragraphs. Then we'll go into the musical break. We'll lead into your story, and then we'll go into Moses Maimonides, physician, scientist, and philosopher. How does that sound?
Hey, okay.
Okay, so let's finish up these last three paragraphs. It only takes minutes, but the children need to discuss with their parents what they should be thinking about during the powerful moment of silence in school. The kids are now expected to look up to their parents as their moral/spiritual authorities, but consider also what it does for the parents' self-esteem when the school officially recognizes them as moral/spiritual authorities. And in order to help their children think of topics for a moment of silent contemplation, the parents need to think about it as well. And because parents care about their children more than anyone else, they tend to take their role in a moment of silence seriously. This simple activity completely avoids problems of conflicts between school and parent over values, because the parents are relied on for the values, as they should be. The values can be religious or secular. And if the kids prefer to spend their moment of silence fantasizing about pleasures, thinking about their parents' values are wrong, or thinking about nothing at all, that is fine too. No one knows the better. Regardless of what any individual child is thinking during a moment of silence, the majority are thinking positive things and doing so at the same time. Children are less likely to behave badly when they have begun the day together silently, contemplating even each in their own way, how to improve their lives and the world. It should not be surprising that a moment of silence is profoundly powerful and is almost universally loved by the parents, staff, and students of the schools. And I should have put this in italics and underlined it and bold-faced it, that practice it seriously. So this is not a matter which should be taken lightly. If there's an engagement from three entities, parents, teaching and administrative staff, And, of course, last but not least, the students. If they all practice it seriously, that Mr. Kalman, as a school psychologist, saying this is something which should become more and more present in the school systems in this country and hopefully in the school systems around the world. So with this being said, Buses, we're going to go now to a beautiful segue, 4 minutes and 14 seconds of Kitaro Silk Road, which is, Kitaro to me is one of the great musicians of our generation from Japan. He has done a lot to advance, you know, like say Bob Marley advanced the awareness of the Afro-Caribbean experience and how it blended so successfully into mainstream society. I mean, people know what reggae music is now. But Kitaro, not to the same commercial success or cultural awareness success as Bob Marley, he himself has left an indelible impression among many people in the world. In fact, I think he had an album that went silver or gold in America about 26, 27 years ago. But here's a song called Silk Road Blessings. I hope you enjoy it. I can never tire of this song. It's a song to help you. In fact, prepare yourself if you want to, even if you're not a school child, even if you're not a parent, even if you're not a teacher or a school administrator, to prepare for your own personal time when you want to have a moment of silence. Here we go. This is Kitaro Silk Road. Enjoy, everyone. Thank you. bless you. So that was Silk Road by Kitaro. And Dennis, before you get into the story, I have to let this out, that when I hear music like that by such a man, he's probably close to somewhere between 66 and 70 years old now, that, you know, his generation was the generation after the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And I don't want to go into a political discussion about that because, you know, there was Emperor Hirohito, and he was worshipped by the masses in Japan, and they certainly were involved in acts which we cannot applaud. But that generation that came after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, in individuals like himself, Kitaro, and Professor Michio Kaku, was considered to be one of the primary students of Einstein-type physics. And now Dr. Kaku has no problem at all dealing with quantum physics. He is the co-inventor of the string theory. That type of music to me, which is to me is the essence of art, after something very negative happens, to put together a collection of sounds to give hope to humanity, to give faith to humanity, that no matter how destructive man's actions could have led to incurring the wrath of the Almighty because of the actions of man, not because of the wrath of the Almighty, but the man's actions have led to cataclysmic circumstances, there's always a time to rebuild, there's always a time to be renewed, there's always a time to reinvest one's simple faith back at the Most High, to learn from our mistakes as a human family experience and move further on. Dennis, any comments?
Yeah, I got an obvious comment, and I'm surprised you didn't make the connection, Don. Instead of having a moment of silence or a moment of reflection, wouldn't it be great if we could play 1 minute of that music and let all the kids hear it? And just let's see what happens, what will evolve from that. Nothing bad could come out of it. And why let them wander with their own thoughts when such forceful spiritual type of sounds could direct them in a good direction?
True. Listen, you know, music has always been an aid to ratcheting up human consciousness. But I will agree with you. I think this music should be played universally to every school child starting at the tender age of, say, 3, if they're in nursery school or pre-1A, whatever you want to call it. But there comes a point where, you know, the music ends, and then the child has to make music in their own mind of positivity and hope and faith and all these things. So music to me, I can't go a day without music. I say it flippantly, it's one of my drugs of choice, music, along with a good cup of coffee. But there comes a point where I have to stop drinking the coffee, and I have to stop listening to the music, and I have to think for myself. So I'm agreeing with you. I'm just saying I would say what your viewpoint is an embellishment of the moment of silence, but I wouldn't do away with the moment of silence. So anyway, you want to mention this story now about some black-hatted conservative-thinking individual.
Well, it's a friend of mine who is an ultra-conservative. He's a nice guy, and he's very knowledgeable about things. So I told him, I said, well, I do a radio program once a week usually. And he says, what is it? And I told him, et cetera. And he says, what do you use for your reference? I said, oh, the Guide to the Perplexed. I love Maimonides. He said, what? That's too deep. Too deep. And he started yelling at me that it was too deep. Well, I thought to myself, I said, here's a nice mild-mannered guy. We're talking about Maimonides, but the Guide to the Perplexed is a cornerstone of a lot of thinking of humanity put together. And
right.
And he's saying it's too deep. And I'm saying, why in the world is he saying it's too deep? So I listen to people, and I said, wait a minute. I got a book at home that I know I remember reading. And in it, it's called The Wisdom of Maimonides. That's the main title. The Life and Writings of the Jewish Sage. And it's written by an Edward Hoffman. So I went back and picked it up again, saying, wait a minute, if he says it's too deep, then what is this guy writing about if it's too deep? So what happens is this man, Edward Hoffman, happens to be, has a doctorate in psychology, similar to the man you mentioned, is also in psychology.
Right.
Matter of fact, it was written in 1984, and he was, at that time, He was a professor at Yeshiva University.
Uh-huh.
So he's written many books on psychology and many books on Maimonides. So I said, well, let me go back and look at this book. And the one thing the man says that his book is different from all the others is because he says he's used the English language to get to the essence of Maimonides without distortion. So I started reading it, and I said, wow, I mean, the clarity is there, the smoothness of the English language, and I said, maybe that's what my friend, who's the ultra-conservative, was saying, that it's too deep because it's hard to understand in the stilted English that it is presented in certain cases. I said, but here's a modern man who's saying that he's using the language to get the idea across. So,
sure.
Am I feeding your interest on?
No, No, listen, I think that, Maimonides was always someone who was, what do they say, ahead of the curve? So
well,
he was
I was
going to
read a passage out of this book. Now,
sure.
You can easily get it at half.com for a couple of bucks. It's less than 200 pages in there. So we can always get back to the other book. I just want to do this because it's apropos that what you encountered, that a psychologist is taking time out to help people understand. And to me, that's an important thing because we've had many leaders, Jewish leaders, all different religious leaders, who say profound things, but it's hard to get to the masses because...
That's right.
I don't know what direction they're listening to or what is distracting them, but here's a guy who's trying to put it in simple English, okay? So let me just read something here.
Sure.
The one chapter here is called The Foundations of Judaism. He says, precisely how Maimonides views Judaism and his own mission regarding its place in the world remains a fascinating question. It is also highly complex one. Why? Because the course of the influential life, his perspective not only kept evolving, but also reflecting widely diverse intended audiences. These range from erudite rabbinical colleagues to ordinary Jews seeking to bolster their shaky faith and faltering communal identity, to famous Muslim philosophers and rulers, to suffering medical patients. We cannot possibly expect that a wise leader would offer the same religious message to them all. To do this is to fall into a trap that seems to have ensnared scholars for centuries through the present day. It seems more productive, therefore, to find the Jewish core, in quotes, of Maimonides' soul, not only in his extensive and sometimes contradictory writing, but also in that psychology today calls biodata, his interests, activities, accomplishments, and what does such a fresh approach tell us? For reasons of brevity, these answers are most salient. First, that Maimonides maintained an intense devotion to Judaism throughout his life. In the existence that his emotionally refrained temperament permitted, and is not only heartfelt but impassioned as well. From youth in Spain through steadily declining health in Egypt, his commitment to Jewish teachings was unflagging. It encompassed both scholarly and communal dimensions that never really shifted. His loyalty to Judaism as embodied community of individuals with human flaws and frailties was equally unshakable. Second, it's clear that Maimonides' particular attraction for Jewish tradition was primarily intellectual. Again, the issue of temperament of highly relevant for scholarly activity, reading and engaging in commentary, was always his favorite pastime. Though as a physician he recommended music for its uplifting and curative power, there's no evidence that Maimonides ever composed liturgy, led in synagogues in songful worship, or played any musical instrument. Likewise, he never composed poems or even dabbled in poetry as a young man. In fact, history believe it was the one subject he abhorred, even though in his early education. In an Andalusian culture in which rabbis typically wrote with flowery imagery and metaphor, even in matters of theology, Mayamati's penchant for precise prose well reveals his somber personality and how it meshed with Judaism. Finally, Maimonides was clearly drawn intellectually to non-Jewish sources throughout his life. No doubt, this reflected his conviction that knowledge of the cosmos was hardly limited to Jews, but accessible to all humanity. The notion sometimes advanced by historians that Maimonides became enamored with Greek philosophy only late in his career, when composing The Guide for the Perplexed, is absurd. For by his early 20s, he had already written a careful introduction to logic in a treatise that contained nothing of Judaism. Association with prominent Muslim thinkers would only strengthen his view that truth can be universally grasped. Such a view, especially in Maimonides' medieval milieu, would not have been incompatible in the least with the prophetic faith of Jewish commitment, redemption, and messianism that he unfailingly embraced.
Beautiful, Dennis. You know, Dennis, I'll tell you that the secret that made Rabbi Moshe Ben Maimon what he was, which, you know, on his tombstone, I've seen it written on his tombstone in Tiberias in Israel, from Moshe to Moshe, there never rose up another like Moshe. And this insight that I want to share with you based on these teachings, which are just so beautiful and wonderful and so profound and yet so simple, is that basically Rav Hillel Meir Parch taught that you have two different types of teachers. They both have tremendous amount of knowledge. But the difference in them is that teacher A doesn't bring it down in a way that the person receiving doesn't feel anything except, this person has a lot of knowledge that he's sharing with me, and I'm basically overwhelmed with it. And then on the flip side of it, there's a tinge of ego that the teacher of such, or the possessor, as the possessor of such bountiful amounts of knowledge, does not want to humble themselves to contract their knowledge to make it more accessible to the masses. Then there's teacher number B, which is the preferable mode of teaching, which is basically, I think, is the secret and the key to all successful, quote-unquote, masters, or whether it be Torah or other faiths or secular wisdom, scientific endeavors, is that when they share something to the masses, their implicit message is to them, listen, what I'm sharing to you might seem like a bottomless pit or a depth of an ocean or the tip of an iceberg, which there's 99.99% of the iceberg you're not seeing, but I want you to know, all I'm offering you is a level of profundity of a tip of a one drop of ocean water, and just think about how much more that ocean is surely more profound than that one drop of ocean water. And therefore, they empower the student, yes, to at times to be a little overwhelmed by that little drop of water of information, but also to encourage them, go ahead, jump into the water, immerse yourself in this wisdom. You know what? I won't be surprised, teacher B will say, is you'll come up with an idea that I didn't think of. And then teacher B is blessed with that type of, you know, empowerment that he can empower others. And they move from strength to strength in their ability to teach. And therefore, Rambam was in a process which he naturally had to follow because he realized he wasn't the ocean. He was just a drop in the ocean. He was just sharing a drop in the ocean with other people, Dennis, and blessed souls out there listening. So I think, Dennis, that's why Rambam is who he is and always will be and historically can be looked back as. And Moses as well, another great teacher, whoever you want to name. The great teachers are the ones who say, I'm not the ocean. I'm sharing with you merely a drop on the ocean. Now, with that being said, Dennis, you mentioned that Rambam didn't read any poetry. And I had promised a good friend on Facebook, Exile, that I would I was so taken by a poem of his, and we have about, let's see, we have about, how much time do we have left? We have about 9 minutes left, so I'd like to take the next couple minutes to read this poem, because, you know, I think this is what we call in Yiddish a heartsick presentation. What we're doing tonight, I think, are really sharing our hearts with other blessed souls, which hopefully will allow them and encourage them, empower them to join us in future more regular presentations of In Search of Ancient Torah, Dennis. So here's the poem I'm going to share with you. This is called The Most High's Love Came A-Calling. Love came a-calling, calling. The Most High's love came a-calling. The Most High's love came a-calling at my window late last night, using words I had forgotten, but I always knew were right. They say in the darkest hour always shines the brightest light, and the path is made much clearer when the love light hits your eyes. The Most High's love came a-calling at my window late last night. This love is a warrior, never a pacifist, and I don't need no human/Lord to argue this. If you seek the truth now, is there any risk? And Lord, I've been so long now on that old, quote-unquote, old blacklist, but the Most High's love came a-calling at my window late last night. I took a little trip, you know, back to the other side. I call it incognito, but from the one I could not hide. Ancient masks they covered, Lord from head to toe, seeking just one answer, but nobody seemed to know. But the Most High's love came a-calling at my window late last night. Love calling, the Most High's love calling. Most High's love calling came a-calling at my window last night, using words I'd forgotten, but I always knew were right. They say in the darkest hour always shines the brightest light, and the path is much simpler when the love light hits your eyes. The Most High's love came a-calling at my window late last night, saying, Most High Lord, I begged for truth. I heard their voices had lied, and in my scorn it laughed out loud, but in no sense still cried. And I saw that now wrote, yeah, but my path was cut so wide, and I could not close the gap, no matter how hard I tried. But the Most High's love came a-calling to my window late last night. I visioned tidal waves were running, Lord, over 30 feet tall, and all I found for protection was a 29-foot wall. But as I started to go down, I heard all the children call, all is not as it seems, and the waves, they seem to stall. Love calling, the Most High's love is calling. Love calling, the Most High's love is calling. The Most High's love came a-calling at my window late last night, using words I'd forgotten, but I always knew were right. They say in the darkest hour always shines the brightest light. The path is made much clearer when the love light hits your eyes. The Most High's love came a-calling at my window late last night. And I heard, quote, I am the only answer. It has always been, grab hold to me, my child, and don't ever let go again. The Most High's love, the Most High's love, the Most High's love calling, yeah, ah. The Most High's love came a-calling at my window late last night. Say, the body may get weary, but the spirit never dies. The spirit never dies, and the path is made much simpler when the Most High's love hits your eyes. When the Most High's love hits your eyes. In the darkest hour always shines the brightest light. The Most High's love came a-calling at my window late last night. One love by Exiled, Facebook friend in Facebook. Dennis, any comments on that ditty?
What's the name of the poem?
The name of the poem is, let me just pull that back up again.
Most High's love?
The Most High's love came calling.
Came calling.
Yeah, well, he wrote it, called Jag, which is the Rastafarian way of expressing the name of God. in Europe, they didn't pronounce a yes sound. So it's pronounced Jah, which is referring to the Most High. So I say the Most High's love came a-calling. I spoke to Exiled. He said he didn't mind me if I changed it to make it something using a language referring to God, of course, in a way that more people perhaps could relate to.
Okay. Because I've seen a compendium of everything he wrote. And I don't remember seeing that on the list at all, Don. But there's also a physician's prayer that a lot of people attribute to him that he wrote. But historians have checked it out and said, no, he didn't write it. it had to be a good admirer of his who wanted him to get the credit for writing, but Mayamati did not write that physician's prayer. But yeah.
By the way, I want to mention to you that we have another poet who's listening to the show, Dennis. Her name is Sivan Ariel, and I think she's in Atlanta, Georgia, if I remember correctly. And she's come on the show in the past, if you recall. Maybe she came on the show before you started being a regular co-host. She wrote, first of all, she commented to me that what you wrote about, what you read about Maimonides, quote-unquote, this is an interesting read about the rabbi. And then she wrote about the poem. I love that poem, The Most High Love Came Calling. So I think thank you very much, Sivan, and hopefully in the future we'll have one of your great poems read by you, in fact, Sivan. Anyway, Dennis, you know what? We've actually run out of time. We wanted to cover other stuff, but I want to thank you profusely for being flexible enough to work with a kind of impromptu type of guy that I sometimes am, as you've learned in the last couple of weeks when we scheduled shows and had to cancel for whatever reasons. I thank you profusely for being flexible with me tonight and giving an example to me of how much more flexible I should be myself. So thank you very much, sir, and you have any final comments for our listening audience?
Well, yeah, you're an enjoyable guy, Don, believe it or not. The flexibility is the flexibility that all our listeners should have, too, because we used to say years ago, you have to hang loose. Why? Because life is going to throw you lots of curves.
Okay.
Hang loose and be flexible, and you'll end up loving God.
I mean, they could be stronger sliders than Steve Carlton, what you're saying, the Hall of Fame pitcher.
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you, Dennis, and thank you, Blessed Listening. Thank you, Stephen Ariel. Thank you, Exile. And we're going to end the show tonight. No pun intended, but it's a great song. Simon and Garfunkel, Sounds of Silence. Until we reunite next week, hopefully, Blessed Souls, with our regularly scheduled program, In Search of Ancient Torah. Ahav Echad, one love, Goral Echad, one destiny, L'kolon for all of us, B'darchi Shalom, and a peace way, U'darchi Naam. Sounds of Silence by Simon and Garfunkel. Enjoy.
Darkness, my old friend, I've come to talk with you again, because a vision softly creeping left its face while I was sleeping, and the vision that was planted in my brain still remains. Thank you.